None of the CEOs in our study, even though they were 5Xers, every CEO we work with, we all have an Achilles heel, right? There are things that we're great at, things that we're not great at. Having that self-awareness is so important to know, who do I need to bring onto my team to cover for that weakness? So the exhaustion happens in large part if you don't have the right team.
This is Revenue Makers, the podcast by Sixth Sense, investigating successful revenue strategies that pushed companies ahead.
So, Saima, I have always felt like in the time I've been working for you that you are sort of on this path to world domination.
Okay.
So at some point that's, you know, running a company, maybe there'll be a PE firm involved. I think they'll come in, they're going to pay a lot of money for your business, and then they're going to make, you're going to make a bunch of money, and then they'll sell it off, and everyone's going to be, but is this going to be money will floweth? But in all of that, the PE world, this is a really great transition, everybody. The PE world is an interesting transition for leadership teams and for CEOs, and especially for marketing leaders and sales leaders, how to understand how to operate in that new world. So with that really poorly done transition, we could talk about today's guests, which they've done an incredible amount of research into work into this very topic.
I like how you tried to bring it all together, Adam. Well done.
I figured if I just said world domination, you'd be so flattered that you could just finish the intro, because I just screwed it up.
Well, I'm happy to finish the intro because this is a great conversation. It is a conversation about a recently released book called The 5X CEO. And in the book, basically, the authors have come up with five main pillars, well, the 5X model, which basically is a framework that focuses on the five essential responsibilities of a CEO and a leadership team. And they didn't just come up with it. They actually interviewed over 75 high-performing PE-backed CEOs, CEOs that have delivered multiples on investments of 6.2. You know, the average PE firm, I think, looks for like a 3X multiple. These CEOs delivered an average of over 6. And so they took those conversations and that research and came up with the 5X framework. And so I'm so thrilled that we were able to speak with Sam Allison and Tavo Gottfredson. Both are co-founders of Advantage CEO. And they're just wonderful people and humans in general, which comes across in the episode. But they have such a great way of delivering the research and the 5X model with tangible examples, anecdotes, specifics about how these CEOs take what can be very challenging mandates and translate them into a whole lot of money, like you said.
Yeah, a whole lot. And just a masterclass, really, in just understanding leadership as well. So let's dive into it.
Let's do it. Tavo and Sam, thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited to chat through your new book, The 5X CEO, which came about through a very deep set of research, right? I'll give the highlights, but over 75 in-depth interviews with high-performing PE-backed CEOs with an average of like 12 years of experience and a multiple on investment of over 5X, right? Did I get that right?
That is right. The multiple on invested capital average for the CEOs that we interviewed as part of our research was 6.2. So typically in private equity, they're striving for, you know, maybe 3x. And so the average for our crew was 6.2. We actually cut off some of the tails when we were calculating, but we had some phenomenal results for the CEOs that were involved.
And so that ends up being kind of, you're synthesizing over 900 years of cumulative private equity and leadership experience. And so the fact that you were able to boil it down into a handful of, here are the commonalities and the common characteristics we see, you kind of did the hard work for us.
We got inspired to do this research in large part because many of you may not know that more than 50% of CEOs actually don't make it through the hold period. And the hold period is the duration from which in private equity, they typically buy a company, put on their special magic, and sell the company in about 5 years. That's always the goal. And so about 50% of CEOs actually don't make it through the hold period. That signaled to us a systemic challenge within private equity it was about more than just making better hiring decisions. It was more about how PE CEOs are supported, developed, and aligned with their firms. And so that's what really inspired the research to start. And then I'm going to let Sam talk about really kind of some headlines about the outcomes of our research.
So all of that information, to your point, we had a tremendous amount of content from really successful people, both on the CEO side and from private equity investors. And the 5X model is really the output of that research. We really didn't go in with a hypothesis. We said, let's go ask a lot of questions and see what that yields. And the model came about. So the model has five components that encompass strategic clarity, scalable talent, relentless focus, disciplined execution, and energized culture. And so those five areas really translate the what and the how that we took away from the CEOs in terms of what they're doing and how they're doing it. And then sprinkled throughout is also the perspective from the private equity investors of what they saw from CEOs and leadership teams who were really able to make a difference. And I think an important point is, while we called it the 5X CEO, it's really about the CEO and the leadership team. So whether it's, you know, for your audience, the chief marketing officer, the sales leadership, it runs throughout the CFO, the HR leader, the IT team. Everyone on the leadership team needs to be engaging in these five areas. And if the team does that really well, we're not saying it guarantees a 5X MOIC, but it certainly better positions you to be successful with each of those. So why don't I quickly share the five components of the model and then we can go into questions. So strategic clarity is really about making sure that everyone is aligned on where the company is going and that everyone from the CEO through all of the employees and the board understands it and understands their role in executing it. Scalable talent is about making sure that you have the right people in the right roles and that as you think about your most critical roles that are really going to drive value, that you have A players in those roles. Relentless focus is about making sure that everyone is laser focused and prioritizing the value creation drivers. So just the handful of things that are really going to alter the trajectory of the business. Disciplined execution is about making sure that you have a management operating system that can drive the business forward, help you monitor your progress, measure, and then pivot as needed. And energized culture is really about it getting engaged employees to be a part of the process.
I mean, again, those five, like, I think obviously our audience is sales, marketing. There's so much there that everybody has to be thinking about. You talk about like CEOs not making it through the holding period. I do know this probably for marketing leaders and sales leaders that haven't gone through one of these processes before, the acquisition, the whole period and all that. And I think it's probably viewed as, in some cases, like, okay, time for me to find another job, right? Because, and I've seen many, again, I've known people, especially marketing leaders, that like PE comes in, hey, you have to execute our playbook. These large PE firms, like, they kind of know what they're doing, clearly, right? They're making billions of dollars and so forth. And so, and for a lot of marketers, it's either I can't do that, I won't do that. How would you describe or think about, if I'm sitting in seat anywhere in the C-suite or leadership, and this PE process is starting, beyond those five pieces, what's going to make sure that A, I can adapt? What's going to make me successful making the sort of move from like however we're owned before into this PE world? And then I can take on these five components and actually to make the outcome possible.
A lot of individuals could freak out if private equity is going to be buying your company. And we really believe it should be the opposite, because the private equity firm is buying your company because they believe in your company. There's a reason they're buying your company, because they see so much promise and opportunity with your company. And so if you're sitting in that role, it's really thinking about how can I help grow this company to the next level and really understand the private equity firm's investment thesis, where they have an understanding around how they can really capture value or unlock value within the company. And so part of it is saying to yourself, okay, I'm in a role. Take yourself out of it. What's really needed from this role to take this company to where it needs to get to in the next 5 years? And to think about how well you match to that role. And that role can change over time. And so one of the most important points I would make is it's so important that you're growing in alignment with the growth of the organization and that you're building on your skills and your capabilities so you can be more valuable, but also help the company get to the next level. I'll let Sam add to that.
I totally agree. So a private equity entry, to me, is just a huge opportunity. And so what's most important, to Tavo's point, is understanding what that investment thesis is about your business. Why do they think there's opportunity? Where do they see those value creation drivers? And then how can you connect your efforts to those value creation drivers, regardless of the role that you're in? So whether you're in a marketing or a sales or a technology or HR, whatever it is, how does your role connect to that and help drive the business forward? And the beauty of private equity is if you're successful in that, the financial rewards are there, but also the professional rewards are there, right? So you can continue to grow your skill set, learn new things, and there's just a lot of opportunity and activity out there. I think the other piece I would add is with private equity, there's a mix, right? Typically, you want to drive both organic growth and acquisition activity. And so again, from a professional standpoint, tons of opportunity to engage and develop and grow as an individual, both in terms of thinking, how do you support organic growth efforts, but also how do you successfully, you know, assess, diligence, procure, and then integrate acquisition opportunities and capture the value of the opportunity there as well.
I love that you positioned it as an opportunity, Sam, which I think is just the biggest takeaway for me. Digging into the 5X model, strategic clarity is probably the one everyone would associate with the CEO, right? That's pretty clear. The CEO is setting the strategy from the very top. I think where we've seen things fall down is when that strategic clarity is not permeating through the rest of the org, or when even just that strategy is not long-term or broad enough. And I think we are today living through a very big wave of change and innovation, particularly with AI. So what did you specifically see from your research around length of strategy and then also just making sure it becomes really ubiquitous throughout the org?
Typically, the CEOs that we talk to are looking at a 3 to 5 year strategic plan. And so that's working with the investment thesis that the private equity sponsor initiates and then validating that, you know, assessing that, diligencing that, and translating that into a more specific strategic plan. And we talk a lot about in the book about how to do that. But they're typically looking at 3 to 5 years. However, they're refreshing it on an annual basis. So to your point that especially with so much change happening so quickly right now, you can't go in and say, okay, this is it, and I'm not going to reassess along the way. But I think that's a great opportunity for sales and marketing leaders to really chime in. I think first, you know, to your earlier point about how do you make sure that that clarity permeates the organization, marketing can play a tremendous role in that of how do you simplify the language around the strategy and make sure that it is really clear, both internally and externally. And from a sales perspective, how are you bringing the field information, the customer perspective, the competitive knowledge and information to help frame that strategy? And then what are you doing to really help the business think about the value proposition that you're offering? And then how does that translate through the strategy? And what are some of the changes you need to make over time?
I think one of the biggest mistakes organizations can make is that the strategy gets trapped at the top. The executive team may understand the strategy, but everyone who's actually interfacing with customers don't understand how the work that they're doing connects to the broader purpose of the organization. So really good leadership teams, and we talk about it in the book, where literally the receptionist of the organization could tell you, I'm associated with this initiative that's driving this value for the organization. Literally, that level of clarity is so important. And then having a plan that not only the leadership team can implement, but the leadership team is aligned on and believes can win. And so a lot can change and you have to adapt your plan. Maybe your competitors come out with a better product. Okay, that means we may need to double down on service to win the game. And where leadership teams fall short is when they don't define reality or see reality in the same way. And so they have to understand what winning looks like, but also understand reality together in the same way.
A PE firm is attracted to an organization for a lot of different reasons. And would you say that that strategic clarity is in place as one of the sort of core components of, hey, this is an attractive acquisition for a PE firm? And even if that's the case, there's still this time where they're going to, even in either during diligence or going to come in afterwards and actually help to define, refine. You talk a little bit about like the participation. Let's say we're the most like well-oiled machine when it comes to from an executive standpoint. We have our strategic clarity. PE firm comes in. What's going to happen? Are we going to see, hey, you guys are doing it well. We're the catalyst, or let's rewrite it, or let's meet in the middle, or what have you seen there?
It depends on the firm and the business. So if the team may be operating under a strategic plan that has, you know, gotten them from point A to point B, and the private equity sponsor may say, okay, we think that they're on a good course and we see how, you know, point B can lead to point C and there's more growth here and it's just scaling. You know, have they put a nice platform in place with some good structure, some processes, right? Do they have the five components of the model, right? So are they focused? Do they have a management operating system? Do they have a culture that's working, right? So do they have the five components? It's absolutely possible for a company to have those five components and then for a private equity firm to bring in some incremental capital and really position them to take off and scale on a more rapid pace than perhaps what they were doing before. It's also possible that the private equity sponsor is looking at the business and thinking, we see incremental opportunity here. We think there's more, you know, acquisition opportunity, or we think we can pivot into a different arena and really drive more growth. So it really varies. What's most important is understanding what is that thesis, and then how does that connect to the strategic plan? Where are the presumed value creation drivers? That has to happen no matter what.
And that's a really important point, which is it really is up to the CEO and the leadership team to say, these are the initiatives that are going to get us from A to B, and then from B to C. And so, you know, the private equity firm is not going to provide you those initiatives, right? And so we have to hit a number. You have to create a plan that gets you in the initiatives that are going to drive towards that exit.
Relentless focus. You can't do anything and everything. No matter, you know, if it's strategically important at the end of the day. And so much of what the best leaders do is minimize thrash within their organizations, minimize shiny object syndrome, and really focus them around a set of 2, 3, 4 major initiatives. Can you shine some light on what you heard in the research?
First, just from our own experience, I mean, this shined through in the research, but I could tell you that almost every senior leadership team that we've worked with tries to do too much all at once. And so the key is around having immense discipline around doing the few things exceptionally well. And look, when you get to an executive role, you know, everyone's a high achiever. And so you have this belief or perception that you can just keep on doing more. That's a false belief. And so really thinking about how much capacity do we have in this organization in terms of talent, resources, time, all of that, and aligning it to the precious few that will have the biggest impact on the organization's success. And I'll let Sam continue.
So there's a case study in the book. So each section of the book also has a case study, which was a CEO from our research that we felt really demonstrated that component of the model extremely well. And so on relentless focus, we had a CEO who one of her methodologies was spending time with the leadership team and thinking about what are we going to do now? What are we going to do next? But also, what are we going to do never? Or what do we view as for the next ownership period? Mm-hmm. And being really intentional about what we're going to focus on and taking some things off of the list or halting and pausing, you know, some of the initiatives and really bringing the business back to the core. And so that's just as important is looking at everything that's happening in the business and stopping things that don't make sense so that the team has that capacity that Tavo talked about to focus on the things that do and then limiting what's on that list and having a next up so that you're constantly driving that method with the team to say, okay, these are the top 1, 2, 3 priorities. everybody's focused here, and then this comes after, so that you let everybody understand that path and pacing, but don't allow them to get too distracted by things that just don't make it to the top of the list.
There are a lot of distractions as well. Those can come from the PE firm as well, around asking for things or suggesting things. And these CEOs were capable of pushing back and making sure that the precious management time that they had was allocated to things that matter, and they blocked out the noise.
That makes a lot of sense. I think the next couple that are, I think there are two that are intertwined, certainly, but I really want to dig into, certainly, discipline execution, sort of the concept of this management OS. And of course, that's going to go right into scalable talent, certainly. But when you talk about a management OS, you sort of alluded to it earlier about having just like an incredible discipline on, I'm involved with strategic value X, it's going to do to drive value Y, you know, that very much so like spelled out. Can you talk a little bit about like what's the sort of the best that you've seen or the best you saw in the research on this building? I mean, again, I love that it's called an operating system or an OS.
In our research, we didn't see one method that was consistent across all of the CEOs. What was consistent was that they had a management operating system. They had something. And so whether, you know, our case study in that case talks about V2MOM, which was came out of Salesforce. And that's a great methodology. It's not for everybody. And so other people used, you know, OKRs. We had some who sort of created their own system. And so we've got a couple of examples. It's just really, really important that there is a discipline and that there's a common language that's used across the organization. Because that was another point that the CEOs raised to us was, as a CEO, I can't be using V2MOM and then have somebody on my staff who wants to use OKR or their own thing, because then people get confused. So it's, how do you keep it as simple as possible, but make sure you've got that structured rigor and that it flows through into your meeting cadence, your language that you're using, how you're holding people accountable, the metrics that you're looking at. It all has to connect together to make sure that you're moving the business along the path of the strategic plan.
A simple way to look at it too is, what's the operating rhythm of the company, right? Around how we meet, how we engage. And from a metrics perspective, like, are we looking at lagging indicators or leading indicators in order to drive the work that we're doing inside the organization? And so one thing that I think is so important, even looking at your own leadership team, that weekly senior leadership meeting is so important to your success. It's something that you should always be looking to continue, refine, and improve upon. But also just the organization's meeting cadence overall, and having the right balance between very tactical meetings, but also strategic meetings as well. So as part of your leadership team, what's the right ratio that you need to have around working on the business versus in the business? And so thinking about that schematically from the meetings that you have, like some organizations have way too many meetings that are super inefficient. Others can be just super tactical. So understanding the right meeting structure for your team and your organization is mission critical.
I'll just build on that a little bit. That's really important. So if you're the head of marketing or sales, what is your rhythm for your team? How are you making sure that you're elevating to have strategic conversations, you know, typically monthly or quarterly? And of course, then you're more tactical that flow into that weekly or daily, right? Depending on the rhythm of your team. And so following that same principle for your domain and what you can control, and then ideally working with the rest of the leadership team to put it in place across the business.
Given that we've talked about clarity on the strategy and executing really well, I feel like some of those tenets create a very energizing, excellent culture on their own, right? The fact that if you've got the right people in the role, everyone is moving towards the same overall, you know, North Star. That in itself is great. What specifically did you hear in terms of how CEOs or leadership teams in general are able to really drive a great culture within an org?
I would say, first, like, culture is almost both a process and an outcome. Your culture is a result of kind of all these other things around the strategy, around the talent, around focus, execution, all those things, right? It's the way that we behave. It's the processes within the organization. And from a culture perspective, you know, if you're on a leadership team, you guys are the ultimate standard setters for behavior inside your organization. And so in many ways, your culture is what you tolerate. One of the CEOs in our study always talked about the types of people that he wanted to bring into the organization. And he talked about two things. You need to be competent and you need to be kind. Those are the two types of people. You need to have these two things to be successful in our organization. And what happened was he had brought on a high profile executive into the company. And this person was in a role for 1 week. Long story short, that executive ended up berating a group of employees. The CEO confronted him about this. He acknowledged that he had done it and the reason why. And then the CEO said to that particular executive, okay, today is your last day. I had told you that competence and kindness were our calling cards in terms of who we are as an organization. And this clearly just isn't a fit. That had more of an impact in shaping the culture than probably anything else the CEO did in terms of what you tolerate.
I mean, that's a huge one. Again, like you always hear about organizations like, well, they hit their number, or they're doing incredibly well. But like someone that could be the most successful salesperson or whatever it may be, but they're toxic to the culture and then not doing something about it. To your point, it being so impactful that they did do something about it.
It gets at making sure that you're on an ongoing basis and as part of assessing employee performance, that you're thinking both about results and behaviors. So are they demonstrating the values of the organization? Do the values flow into their decision-making, the way they behave? And, you know, make sure that you're looking at both and not just one. Too often you see organizations that are just looking at the results and not thinking about what it takes to get there. And, you know, there's a quote in the book about somebody who leaves, you know, a big wake and is doing a lot of damage, even though they get the results. In the end, that can fundamentally erode the culture and cause issues. I think the other big thing that we saw is using tools to measure culture. So how are you thinking about employee net promoter score and other survey opportunities to really try to engage and solicit, make sure that feedback is two-way? So we talk a lot in the book about communication and the importance of cascading messages down through, you know, throughout the employees, the receptionist example that Tavo mentioned. But what are you doing to make sure there's a mechanism for that feedback to surface back up? And then most importantly, if you're surveying or collecting that feedback, you have to take action. And so too often we see, you know, leadership teams who are collecting input and then it just sort of gets on a shelf somewhere and nobody's doing anything about it. And so again, how do you make sure it flows back into that rhythm of the business that we talked about, that you're following through, you know, gathering takeaways from the survey feedback and the other feedback that you're getting and then following through to actually take action on it and make change?
When we talk about scalable talent, right? We talk certainly like talent as part of the execution. In terms of defining, I mean, using the word scalable, certainly like people that can grow, people that can execute. But what are some of the best things that you saw from that perspective in the research?
One of the most common phrases, by the way, that we heard in our research over and over again was, do they know what good looks like? So in other words, if you're part of a leadership team, and the private equity firm is thinking this way as well, which is, okay, we're 50 million today, we got to get to 200 million in 5 years. Who's played at the $200 million level? Who understands what needs to be built, processes, the systems, all of that to play at this $200 million level? So from a scalable perspective, it's understanding what good looks like, but it's also being able to empower, let go, so you can really start to change the growth trajectory of the organization as well. So moving from very tactical to more strategic, that's also part of this scaling journey as well.
And I'll add to that, coming back to the opportunity conversation we had earlier, oftentimes a CEO will come into an organization and is assessing the talent, and not everyone is going to make it, right? There's inevitably at least usually a handful or a couple of people that they may swap out, which does not mean that whomever is in the position has to leave. It may just mean that they move into a different role within the organization. But I think that there's this notion of thinking through, where is the business today? And as I look at the talent that I have in the organization, as I look at my strategic plan and what needs to happen over the next couple of years, do I have the right people in the right seats? And even do they know what good looks like, or do I believe they have the potential to execute and get us there? And so one of the CEOs that we interviewed talked about part of their annual performance process is looking and asking themselves for, you know, every manager asks themselves about their team members, knowing what I know now about what the business needs to do for the next 2 years, would I hire this person again? So they might have been an amazing talent and helped me get from point A to point B. But as I look at where I'm headed for the future, are they still the right person? Do they still have the right skill sets, or do I believe that they can develop them? And, you know, do I keep investing in this person, or do I need to make an adjustment here? And so it's a great way to think. And, you know, oftentimes as we do performance assessments, you're just looking historically, but having that forward view as well was something that we found was unique coming out of the research and constantly assessing. You know, there were some CEOs who talked about racking and stacking their teams on a quarterly basis and saying, you know, if somebody was always at the bottom, I have to ask myself, why are they always at the bottom of the ranking? And what do I need to do to change that?
Sam and Tavo, we have a question that we ask everyone on the podcast, which is, what is the most ridiculous thing you've been asked to do in your career? But I actually want to change it up a little bit, given that you interviewed so many people. What is the most ridiculous story or anecdote you heard? And that can be good or bad, something that surprised you, made you laugh, horrified you. What did you hear?
I think one of the most unique stories that we heard was from a CEO who was a first-time CEO in his very first board meeting. And the chairman of the board said, okay, we're going to go into executive session now. And the CEO didn't know what that meant. And so he just literally just sat there and it became awkward. And then so the chairman of the board said, excuse me, executive session means that you have to leave the room now because we're going to talk about you. He was embarrassed, got up, left the room. And then he had a moment of reflection where he said to himself, you know what, this is actually a pretty good idea. Why don't I take this process and I'll use it inside my company. I'll just call it the reverse executive session. I'll kick myself out of my weekly senior leadership meeting twice a year and have my chief human resources officer facilitate a session around what I'm doing well, what I need to do to improve or identify any organizational issues. And so it's almost like a 360 that's done twice a year by him just stepping out of the room. So that was a really powerful, I think, and unique example from one of our study participants.
I'll come at it from the private equity perspective. The most ridiculous thing that I heard was a private equity sponsor who would not share the investment thesis with the CEO and the management team, which just to me was ridiculous. And you know, and that was my response was, that's ridiculous. How do you expect the CEO and the leadership team to drive your value creation strategy if you haven't told them what it is? So that's just crazy. So if you find yourself working in a private equity backed organization and that investment thesis hasn't been shared, you need to ask. And if for whatever reason they're ridiculous and don't want to share, then you need to at least engage in a dialogue around, okay, what made you buy us? Where do you see the opportunities? You know, what do you see as the value creation drivers? And how do we translate that into our strategy to move forward? And that's something else that, you know, Tavo and I do as a regular exercise is invite the PE sponsor and the CEO and leadership teams to come together just, you know, for an hour and talk about what is the thesis here? What do we see? And have the management team get to ask all kinds of questions and go through that Q&A process because it just brings a lot of clarity. And we always hear from the management team how valuable it is to just go deeper on what the vision is for the business and how people are thinking about the opportunity.
I'm blown away that you rewrote the last question for the first time in 74 episodes. So like you have changed Revenue Maker's canon forever, but continue,
please.
It's very good. I thought it was great.
No, but I just have one more question that I think is really pertinent to listeners who tend to be go-to-market leaders. And, you know, you gave five examples of characteristics of top performing CEOs and leaders. There's a darker side to that though, right? Number one, I think not everyone is good at everything. And so to embody that results in kind of the second point I want to make is a whole lot of burnout. And how are leaders and the best of the best leaders combating that? How are they getting ahead of it? How are they taking care of themselves in a place where expectations are so high, runways are short? they've got to set that tone.
I'm going to combine both of your statements into one answer. One is, you're right. None of the CEOs in our study, even though they were 5Xers, every CEO we work with, we all have an Achilles heel, right? There are things that we're great at, things that we're not great at. Having that self-awareness is so important, to know, who do I need to bring onto my team to cover for that weakness? So the exhaustion happens in large part if you don't have the right team, or if you're not part of the right team. So if you've got great talent, you've done a really great job of having critical A-plus players in the right roles on your team, and you're not micromanaging your way to success, then you can avoid burnout, even when the pace is, and the speed is there. And so the antidote is really around having the right team that can execute on the strategy.
It is all about that talent. So, to your point, no one can do everything really well. So ideally, you're executing on all five components of the model. But if you can't, then focus on getting the right talent, and then they can help you deliver on the other four.
And the problem is, so many of us have the loyalty or just good enough bug. I wouldn't be where I am today without this person. And so there's a loyalty that you feel, and you can totally understand why you'd feel that way, right? And then this person's good enough. It's going to take too much to kind of bring someone else into the organization. Those two perspectives can really haunt you, where you'll not only will you become exhausted because you won't have some of the right players you need on the team, but you're also not going to get the outcome. So your role is at risk at the same time. And so you always have to be thinking about what's best for the organization. If it's letting someone go that's a B minus that really needs to be an A, that's what's on you as a senior leader inside the organization.
And I think oftentimes we see leaders who are hesitant. I'll go with more C players. They're hesitant to move a C player out of fear and the level of effort that it's going to take to find someone new, to make sure they're the right person, to get them up to speed. Like, oh, it's going to take me 3 months to find the right person, then another 6 months to ramp them, and I'll be 9 to 12 months down the road before I really start to see it. And I've watched this where I've tried to convince in the past and they wouldn't bite the bullet. And then, 12 months from now, they're facing all the same issues and they're that much more burnt out because they're having to carry the ball for that team member instead of just biting the bullet and making the change. And this isn't just at the CEO level, right? Like, this is, go-to-market leaders. You have to look at who's on your team and what do you need, and are you getting what you need, and are you well-positioned with those resources to be successful?
Well, we could go on. There's so much here, but this was a masterclass in just so much. I mean, we talked certainly about the CEO, but so much about just building teams, execution, executive level, working weight, how, like, jam-packed. I'm sure people were taking, if they're not taking notes, and we're going to put in the intro, pull out your notebook, because there's a lot here. So Tavo, Sam, thank you so much for joining us. We will put information about the book in the show notes as well. Thanks again. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Revenue Makers.
Do you have a revenue project you were asked to execute that had wild success? Share your story with us at sixthsense.com/revenue, and we might just ask you to come on the show. And if you don't want to miss the next episode, be sure to follow along on your favorite podcast app.